Order, order.
In the House this week, problems with communications, raised right at the start with this complaint from Labor's chief whip, Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, I want to raise with you a very serious matter with regard to members of Parliament being able to conduct their business, and it does relate to the order of the House. It's come to my attention in the last 24 hours that the Parliamentary Service are using an email security facility that monitors and in some cases monitors the content of and in some cases blocks emails to and from members of Parliament on the basis of government security classification. I had an email exchange last night with a journalist, a member of the press gallery, that was blocked and I was not able to send it because the document that I was attaching, that I had obtained under the Official Information Act, had previously had a government security classification.
Mr Hipkins said it didn't matter how he came to have the document.
The fact that the Parliamentary Service are monitoring the emails coming to and from members of Parliament's email addresses is completely unacceptable. It is clearly a breach of privilege, and I ask that you investigate that matter with some urgency and ensure that that situation is immediately dealt with.
Mr Hipkins was supported by his Labour colleague, David Parker, who was experiencing some deja vu.
This was actually very similar to the issue that was considered by the Privileges Committee in respect of the Andrea Vance and complaint by others, where it was very clearly found by the Privileges Committee that information belonging to members is actually the members' information. It doesn't belong to the Parliamentary Services, it doesn't belong to the government, and it is for members to do what they think they should, pursuant to our rights of freedom of expression that are guaranteed in this House.
The Speaker, David Carter, promised the two Labour MPs that he'd look into it and report back the next day, which he did, starting by explaining that Parliament used an encrypted email system called C-Mail, with C as in look but not an ocean, that encrypts email traffic between state sector organisations.
C-Mail also prevents classified information being inadvertently sent outside of participating organisations. C-Mail has been in use in Parliament since 2007. Mail filters look for the words C-Mail, restricted, sensitive, or in confidence, which are attached to emails and documents at the choice of the sender. It then applies encryption to the email and attachments before sending them. It does not otherwise scan or store the content of emails. I have been given an absolute assurance that the Parliamentary Service email system does not scan emails, members' emails, other than for spam filtering, viruses, and C-mail classifications.
Despite that assurance and some advice on a workaround method of getting over the blocks imposed by C-mail, Labour MPs peppered the Speaker with questions, including this one from Claire Curran.
Is Parliament able to receive a list of the trigger words that sparks this blocking of documents?
Technical help on that one came from the Attorney-General, Chris Finlayson.
The Speaker's given a very clear ruling. This is a major issue. The system's been in place since 2007. The Speaker's indicated, well, you've indicated, sir, that you're prepared to look at it urgently. It could possibly even go to the Privileges Committee on an urgent basis. We can't be dealing on an episodic basis with a whole lot of technological questions.
Order, order. I think the Attorney General,
an acting IT guy in the chamber. And that wasn't the only communications glitch left unresolved. Thursday's questions for oral answer by ministers included this one for the Minister for Social Development, Anne Tolley, from Green Party co-leader Materia Touré.
Tēnā koe, Mr Speaker. Tēnā koe, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and asks, ka whakai aia ki tā te kawinete o te kotahitanga o ngā whenua o te ao, mō ngā teka tamaiti,
on the rights of the
e tono rā kia whakatū turu tana kawenatanga, me noho tōnā roa rawa atu,
to
ngā pānga pai o te tamaiti,
e
roto i te hininaro, ka whakamanahia ana ngā ture e pāna ki ngā tamariki.
As well as being able to hear the live translation through their headsets, members in the chamber had it printed on their question sheets, where Materia's question to the Minister for Social Development was translated as, does she accept that the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child requires her government to ensure the best interests of the child shall be a paramount consideration in the enactment of laws relating to children? And that question was answered for Ann Tolley by one of her cabinet colleagues.
Oh, the Honourable Hekia Parata.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker.
Ko te whakautu tuatahi ki te mema nāna i pātai mai, kao. Engari, mō te whai haere i tōna pātai, te āhua nei e kōrero ana kē aia mō tētahi atu kaupapa.
Mrs. Parata then elaborated on her answer in English.
I accept that Article 3 of the Convention states that, quote, in all actions concerning children, whether undertaken by public or private social welfare institutions, courts of law, administrative authorities or legislative bodies, the best interest of the child shall be a primary consideration, close quote. The member, however, appears to be referring to Principle 2 of the Declaration of the Rights of the Child, which dates back to 1959 and was the basis of the convention adopted by the United Nations in 1989 and was signed up to by New Zealand in 1993. Minister Tolley is currently leading a delegation to Geneva to discuss New Zealand's report under the United Nations Convention.
Mrs. Parata was then interrupted by a complaint from Matiria Ture.
My question was actually quite simple, is whether she accepts the convention. She doesn't. The issue of Minister Tolley travelling wherever she is of no relevance to the question that was on notice.
The Speaker didn't agree.
I am the sole determinant as to when the answer has gone on for too long, or if I think it's moving into areas that are unnecessary to be an answer to the question.
In any case, Hekia Parata said she had already answered the question.
I answered the first part of her question in Māori, since she had asked it in Māori. So I gave a very definitive answer to the first part, and I went on to elaborate in answer to the second part of her question.
Mrs. Parata later demonstrated her linguistic skills in answer to another question to her as Education Minister about the teaching of Asian languages.
Learning a language helps to build closer relationships with other cultures and countries, and currently there are now 203 schools from Southland to Taitokerau receiving support for Mandarin, Japanese or Korean language programs. Kamsahamnida.
Language difficulties aside, this communication glitch arose when both parties were speaking English.
Point of order.
Point of order.
So just to clarify your ruling, are you saying that what I heard from the Minister was not what he said?
We'll come back to how that miscommunication between Winston Peters and the Speaker developed. Meantime, though, over to Rhys Lyon and life, death and sex in the committee rooms.
A petition signed by more than 2,000 people calling on the government to reverse the convictions of people convicted of consensual homosexual acts prior to the passing of the Homosexual Law Reform Act 1986, as well as calling for an official apology for those convictions, was the subject of a submission to the Justice and Electoral Committee on Thursday. Committee members heard from Ted Greensmith-West, who noted the timeliness of the petition coming before Parliament this year.
This year we remember 30 years since the Homosexual Law Reform Bill was passed in this Parliament.
Mr. Greensmith-West said the law had ruined the lives of convicted homosexuals.
Because they were persecuted for who they were and for fulfilling their sexual desires and their sexuality as they saw fit. It was hate. It is no different than the hate I experienced as a young boy in the changing rooms at school, being spat at, being called a faggot, being bullied, being abused. Except this hate was endorsed by the government.
Mr. Greensmith-West called on the police as well as the government to apologise to those people convicted under the law.
We're talking about the men who had to hide who they were from everyone that they knew. The men who pretended to be flatmates with two separate beds in the house. We're talking about our brothers, our uncles, our husbands in many cases, our cousins, our friends and our family. It is these people that we owe an apology to, that can't even begin to smooth over the wrongs of the past, but apologise we must.
Ted Greensmith-West speaking to the Justice and Electoral Committee. Later in the day on Thursday, the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee met in the afternoon for the presentation of a petition calling for the repatriation of the bodies of New Zealand servicemen buried in Malaysia. The committee heard from the petition's sponsor, Paul Thomas, who said he and four of his brothers had served in the army, one of whom had died on active service.
Adrian was killed in action on the 2nd of May 1956 at the age of 21. And today lies buried in Cherris Road Christian Cemetery, Kuala Lumpur. I believe that the contribution our family has had on the defence of New Zealand has earned my brother Adrian the right to a return flight back to New Zealand. Alongside all his comrades who have all paid the supreme sacrifice for this great nation. I believe it is the right thing to do, and I believe it is the honourable thing to do. Returning the remains, the souls, the spirits of all these brave men back to the bosom of the earth from which they were born.
Mr. Thomas said there were 35 New Zealand servicemen buried in Malaysia.
Not one of these servicemen are buried in a Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery. This means that they are not protected under the Commonwealth War Graves Charter that New Zealand became a signatory to way back in 1916.
Mr. Thomas told the committee that his quest to have his brother's body returned to New Zealand began in 1976 on the wishes of his mother.
The journey I have started will not end, as I have family, friends and relatives who will continue this fight until repatriation is achieved.
Paul Thomas presenting that petition to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee on Thursday. A day earlier, the Health Committee began day two of its hearing of submissions on former Labour MP Marion Street's petition calling for an investigation into public attitudes towards medically assisted dying or euthanasia. The first submission came from the Secretary of the Care Alliance, Matthew Jansen, who advocated for the benefits of palliative or end-of-life care.
Euthanasia and assisted suicide is unnecessary because palliative care works to reduce the suffering of terminal ill patients. We know that physical pain can be well controlled these days. We acknowledge suffering cannot always be totally eliminated because suffering is so complex, but palliative care is effective.
Matthew Jansen said legalised assisted dying put too much power in the hands of doctors and pointed to an overseas example.
Have a look at Holland and their experience. And what you find is that doctors are making more and more choices about end of life because they have been given this very, very big power and they have used it. And so that has given them a license to start thinking about this person in front of me, their quality of life isn't very good. I will move them through into euthanasia.
Care Alliance Secretary Matthew Jansen. And representing doctors in a later submission to the committee was New Zealand Medical Association Chairman Dr. Stephen Child.
We are the New Zealand Medical Association, which represents the views of over 5,500 medical professionals, including students, GPs and specialists. I personally am a Canadian-trained medical specialist who's been practicing here for 26 years at Auckland Hospital in the Department of General Medicine, in which monthly I have patients who die in the hospital and we have discussions around this regard. I'm joined today by Leslie, who's our Chief Executive of the New Zealand Medical Association and extremely experienced and knowledgeable on this topic as well. We're very pleased that we're having an inquiry into society and allowing New Zealand to have this discussion of what is required. For society, to us, it seems there's two questions really facing society. Should a patient be able to ask for assistance for a rational suicide? And can we write a perfect law to assist that rational suicide while still doing all that we can to prevent an irrational suicide? To the medical profession, though, there are some additional questions, and that's why maybe some of our submission may be different than some of the other submissions you've been receiving, because we have to ask the questions that should we as health professionals go beyond what we currently have been able to do for the last 2,500 years? Would this step significantly benefit our patients? And will it fundamentally affect our care and patient relationship? So as such, our discussion might be slightly different, and I just want to make a few little points about our submission, which no doubt you've read. The first point was just about patient autonomy. Clearly, we completely respect patient autonomy. In fact, it's one of our first core ethical principles about patient autonomy and individual choice. But a patient's decision for autonomy needs to be a rational, fully informed decision without coercion, and it must be free will. Decisions, however, are often influenced by circumstance, by fear of what the future might hold, by concern for loved ones, and by societal expectations, which can cause direct and indirect coercion in decision-making. Most importantly, we also know that decision-making fluctuates over time, and yet this is an irreversible decision in which the consequences are final. With regards to our comments on ethics, there are four core ethical principles, and of course we debate and we discuss the right of patient autonomy and individual choice versus first do no harm and work in the best interests of patients, and those are the ethical framework of our discussion. We discussed in our submission about palliative care and the need for increase in support for palliative care, which you've also heard this morning. But in a more subtle way, I just want to give you an example. If I'm doing a ward round at the hospital with a patient who has intractable nausea and vomiting, on Monday I'll go around and I'll prescribe drug A. On Tuesday, if they still have nausea and vomiting, I'll prescribe drug B. On Wednesday, I'll try drug C. On Thursday, I'll go back to the literature. I'll read about everything that I could be missing, review the history and physical examination, do more tests, do everything I possibly can. And on Friday, I might even apply to Peter Dunn for medical cannabis, because doctors do everything we possibly can for our patients. The question is, changing this law would do what to that sequence of events and the way we care for our patient and the way we approach? The other issue we raise in our submission is some of the clinical challenges. Diagnosis. So 10 to 15% of autopsies show that the diagnosis was incorrect. 3% of diagnoses of cancer are incorrect. Last year I saw a 52-year-old smoking female who presented with a lung mass, coughing up blood, severe weight loss. We did all the investigations, including putting a camera down her throat. The cells came back atypical, so suggestive of cancer, but not a cancer. She quit her job. She had her family fly out from Australia. She went to Europe and did her bucket list. 6 months later, she was perfectly okay again. It responded to antibiotics. It was an inflammatory response. Just yesterday in my clinic, I saw a similar story in a 91-year-old in my clinic in the afternoon. We're not always right in diagnosis. We are not always right in prognosis, as Oregon has shown. You need to have a terminal illness with death within 6 months, and there are many examples in Oregon in which death is longer than 6 months. Our ability to predict prognosis is poor. And then there's the issues of deciding capacity. Capacity is an extremely difficult issue. It fluctuates. It can be changed by brain metastasis. It can be changed by opiates. And people will often change their mind, and there can be coercion involved. If I make a decision to commit someone to a rest home, which I do on a sort of fortnightly basis, if I get it wrong, they can come out of the rest home. If I get this one wrong, they can't. And then, of course, there's the legal framework. We've just heard from the Humanist Society and some other presenters about, can you write a law that will 100% protect the vulnerable? We heard the question, I think Simon posed the question, why wouldn't, as one campaigner suggested from overseas, why don't you just make the medication available in the pharmacies if it's all we need is an individual right and choice? And the answer is because we need to protect the vulnerable. The question is, can we protect the vulnerable 100% of the time? And then, of course, there's the wider implications about suicide itself and about a rational suicide versus an irrational suicide. It might be somewhat ironic that last Friday was World Suicide Prevention Day in the world, and we're having this conversation today about legalizing end of life. So in summary, the New Zealand Medical Association's position is that we believe wholeheartedly in patient autonomy and the right for society and the right for you, our politicians, to have this conversation and decide what society would like. We believe wholeheartedly in the right for patients to refuse treatment. We believe wholeheartedly in patients to ask for treatment to be withheld. We believe in the right to good access to palliative care and palliative care services. And we believe in the right of the administration of analgesia and sedation, in other words, pain relief and other medications, for the purpose of relieving pain and suffering, even if the secondary consequence of that treatment may hasten death. Giving morphine to a dying patient is not what we are talking about in this legislation, is not legalizing euthanasia or assisted dying. It is relieving pain and suffering with potential secondary consequences. And there's huge confusion in the literature about issues about that. And in summary, therefore, the New Zealand Medical Association, in balancing all of these issues in principle and practice, does not support a change in the legislation.
New Zealand Medical Association Chairman Dr. Stephen Child speaking to the Health Committee, which will continue hearing submissions on that petition next week. In total, there were 16 committee meetings held during the week.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Back in the debating chamber, Environment Minister Nick Smith was challenged in Thursday's question time about his handling of the government's proposal to establish a marine sanctuary around the Kermadecs. Questions began with this one from Labor's spokesman on fisheries,
Arino Terakatani.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for the Environment. Does he accept that consultation with Māori was inadequate prior to the announcement of the Kermadec sanctuary? And if so, will he now apologise for that mistake?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
No, I do note the Member's party committed to establishing the sanctuary in 2014 prior to any consultation with iwi or TOKM.
TOKM, Te Ohu Kaimoana, the Māori Fisheries Trust, representing iwi and protecting their fishing rights, the subject of Reno Tirukatani's next question.
To the Minister, what compromise is he offering, if any, that would allow the Kermadec sanctuary to go ahead without running roughshod over Māori fishing rights?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, if you're going to have an ocean sanctuary, it needs to be an area in which there is not mining or fishing for it to have integrity. And the challenge we have with it and other marine protected areas around New Zealand is not just in terms of quota rights of Māori, but quota rights of others. I don't think it is a sustainable position to say that non-Māori fishers who have fished in that area for the last 20 years cannot, but Māori who have not been fishing can.
Supplementary question, Reno Terakatani.
Why has he put the future of the Kermadec sanctuary at risk by disrespecting Māori, taking away treaty settlement rights, no recognition of loss, and refusing a reasonable compromise?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, in my discussions with TOKM, the only Kermadec Ocean Sanctuary legislation that they were prepared to accept was one that the fishing ban specifically exempted TOKM and enabled them at their choice to be able to fish at any time in the future. In my view, that would not be a Kermadec Ocean Sanctuary that had integrity, and that is why we were not able to reach agreement. We have said we're going to have ongoing discussions with the Māori Party. In my view, it would be the right thing for New Zealand and this Parliament to still establish that sanctuary.
And this is where the trouble began.
Supplementary question, Reno Terakatani.
To the Minister, why does he think Māori property rights are dispensable after he ignored Ngāti Whātua over Crown land last year and is now trying to extinguish Māori fishing rights this year? Is it disrespect or just flat-out incompetence? What is his problem with Māori?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, I would quote from the policy that member campaigned on in the last election. Because in that, it sets out where Labor would create a world ocean sanctuary.
The Speaker rejected Mr. Tirukatani's complaint that the Minister had no responsibility for the Labor Party's policies.
When you ask a question like that and you effectively accuse a Minister of incompetence, which was the words used in the question, it gives a very wide licence for the answer.
The Minister then assumed that he had a licence to go a bit further.
Point of order, the Honourable Dr.
I seek leave of the House to table Labor's 2014 policy.
Order!
And after sitting the Minister down, the Speaker invited Reno Tirukatani to ask another question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. After running aground yet another government policy, will he excuse himself from further negotiations with Te Ohu Kaimoana so that the Kermadec sanctuary can go ahead, or will he go down with the ship?
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, I've been involved in creating 18 different marine protected areas around New Zealand. For instance, in Akaroa, every one of the ones I've been involved in, there has been some bumps and there has been some controversy. I think the reality is that people are reluctant to give up their rights to mine, to recreationally fish or to commercially fish. And I'm equally confident in this case, with time, we'll find a solution.
Environment Minister Nick Smith, while Wednesday's Question Time saw the Prime Minister, John Key, dragged into the Strippergate controversy involving the Chiefs rugby players, with this question from Labor's Deputy Leader, Annette King.
Will he give an assurance that he will pass on his displeasure at the activities to the Chiefs players who are currently All Blacks when he next meets them? If not, why not?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I don't have all of the details, so I can't tell you exactly the individual players' names. But in terms of discussions with the Rugby Football Union, I think the Rugby Football Union itself has been making the very point, let alone me, that they think this behaviour and the events of a Monday sort of lair-up are not a good idea.
John Key faced more questions from Mrs King about the treatment recently handed out to a stripper at what he called a Monday lair-up.
Does he think he's got credibility to speak for women in light of his own behaviour repeatedly pulling a ponytail of a woman, rather than the minister whose job, he said, is to advocate for women?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, yes I do, and I didn't see the member making a comment yesterday when I gave what I thought was a pretty hard-hitting speech, actually, on domestic violence. The member criticised me for making that speech.
I certainly did not. Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Annette King.
So having decided himself to speak out on behalf of the government, does he think his comments such as disappointing and unacceptable are strong enough when compared to the Minister of Police, Judith Collins, who said, quote, it's time they stopped that stupid behaviour, grew up and apologised?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, yes, I think members opposite will know I'm always a very measured person.
As was his Police Minister, Judith Collins, in her response to this question from her Labour shadow, Stuart Nash.
Why has she changed so much between 2011, when in response to Constable Alana Kane's assault, she thundered that, quote, harsher sentences were needed for people who attack police, end quote, and now when she's silent, when this very same police officer's attacker only received a 300-hour community services sentence?
The Honourable Judith Collins.
Well, Mr Speaker, obviously the member was asleep in 2012 when this Parliament, with this government and me then as the Minister of Justice, actually brought in tougher sentencing as an aggravating factor for people who attacked our first responders, such as police. And I would say to that member, Mr Speaker, do they want to hear or not?
Do they? Order.
There is. This particular case is a matter that is within its appeal time. Personally, I don't want to be the person who stuffs up an appeal case because of an attempt to grandstand.
Finally, the door on the opposition side of the debating chamber got a workout this week, with New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters going through it twice after refusing to obey orders from the Speaker.
Speaker, I don't wish to waste this Parliament's time by apologising for you on that matter. It was crap and it is crap.
Then the member will leave the chamber.
That was Tuesday, then Wednesday, when Mr Peters stood up while the Speaker was already on his feet.
I just want to be absolutely clear. I've given the member a warning that I'm not prepared to tolerate him continuing to raise a point of order that's challenging a ruling I've just given. But if I order, if I detect for... The member will leave the chamber. The member will leave the chamber.
Which will be back in business again from 2 p.m. on Tuesday, when Mr Peters, David Carter and their fellow MPs begin the last week of this three-week sitting period, previewed in Thursday's business statement by the Attorney-General Chris Finlayson, standing in for Jerry Brownlee as Leader of the House.
The acting Leader of the House.
Mr Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday, 20 September, the government will look to complete the first reading of the Statutes Repeal Bill, the third reading of the Evidence Amendment Bill, and to progress a number of other bills on the order paper. Wednesday will be a Members' Day.
Chris Finlayson, acting Leader of the House, and as we heard at the beginning of the program, Parliament's IT guy. I'm Tom Fruin, and this program was made with funding from Parliament.